Abraham Lincoln, Chapter 1, Boyhood Days. In the pioneer country of Kentucky, not so very long before that wild, wooded region became a state, began the life of one of our nation's great men. There, in a remote settlement on Nolan Creek, about 50 miles south of where Louisville now stands, Abraham Lincoln was born. Nothing in his surroundings or his early living conditions foreshadowed the greatness of the man or of his career. Possibly the natural simplicity of his life favored the growth of a great soul. Certainly none of the hampering conditions of luxury, or even of too comfortable living, held it back. The immediate family into which the hero of our story was born was small, there being only his father, Thomas Lincoln, his mother, Nancy Hanks Lincoln, and a little sister, Sarah, 2 years old. But there were many bearing the names of Lincoln and of Hanks in the country. Their ancestry ran back to the early beginnings of New England, and the names themselves were ancient English. With the prosperous and successful branches of the family, we have little to do. Abraham Lincoln himself, in his later years, knew little of them, not even of his grandfather. He said, "I am more concerned to know what his grandson will be." Knowing, therefore, that among Lincoln's ancestors there were able and distinguished men, we may pass over their achievements and begin the story of Abraham Lincoln's life with a brief account of his father. Thomas Lincoln was the youngest of a family of 5 children who were made fatherless by the shot of a stealthy Indian when little Thomas was only 10 years old. From that time, he was set adrift, a wandering, laboring boy, to make his own way in the world. Yet at 25, he had bought a farm in Hardin County, Kentucky, and had learned a trade, being called a good carpenter for those days. So he could not have been altogether idle and shiftless, though history has usually pictured him so. Besides, he was honest and sober, was strong common sense, and was considered by his neighbors good-natured and obliging. And his love of fun and good stories, traits he handed on, made him unusually good company. These qualities, even though he lacked thrift and ambition, won him the affection of the devoted woman who became Abraham's mother. She is described as sweet-tempered and beautiful, the center of all the country merrymaking, and a famous spinner and housewife. She was the niece of Joseph Hanks, in whose shop Thomas Lincoln had learned the carpenter's trade. She was 23 years old at the time of her marriage, 5 years younger than her husband, but superior to him in appearance and in intellect, and in her ability to read and write. For until his wife taught him after their marriage, Thomas Lincoln had never learned, possibly because he had been thrown upon the world so young, or perhaps because he had no liking for books. Indeed, few of their friends could boast this accomplishment. It was on June 12, 1806, that Thomas Lincoln and Nancy Hanks were married in Elizabethtown, Kentucky. The young couple began their housekeeping in a one-room cabin, 14 feet square, like many others, in Elizabethtown. And there in the following year their first child, Sarah, was born. As Thomas did not have enough work as a carpenter to supply the growing needs of his family, he removed to the little farm situated on Nolan Creek, which he had bought 3 years before. Here, on February 12, 1809, Abraham Lincoln was born. Life was already an uphill struggle for the Lincolns, and they soon became very poor. This was largely because the farm alone did not yield a living, and the father did not get sufficient extra employment at his trade. He would turn off work if it came his way, but he did not go to seek it. After a losing struggle on the farm at Nolan Creek, Thomas Lincoln, when little Abe was 4 years old, sold out and bought another farm of 283 acres on Knob Creek, about 15 miles to the northeast, and removed his family to that place. We may imagine that the journey thither through the leafy woods must have been a delight to the 4-year-old boy, who was not old enough to be weighed down by care and disappointment. The songbirds, the flitting squirrels, the flowers, the sunshine, the wind, the trembling leaves and bowing trees, or even the cloud and storm, might well give joy to his sensitive little soul. They lived on the new farm only 3 years, little Abe being 7 years old when they moved away. But after he had grown to manhood, Lincoln could recall incidents of his life at Knob Creek. Here, a baby sister was born and died. Here, the little fellow began manfully to share the family work, fetching and caring for his father, picking berries, even helping to plant seed. But the family fortune did not pick up, and as a dispute arose about the deed of his farm, Thomas Lincoln once more decided to sell out and seek a new home. Most of the good land in Kentucky was being rapidly settled, and a good farm there would have cost more than he was able to pay. Moreover, a brother had prospered in Indiana, and other relatives had gone there. Then, too, as his son said later, he wished to go where there were fewer slaveholders. So this time, Thomas Lincoln decided to leave Kentucky and cross into Indiana. Of the first 7 years of Abraham Lincoln's life, we know almost nothing. His only playmate was his sister, Sarah, for neighbors were not close enough to see much of each other. He must have played much alone in the forest and about the streams, making friends with the world of out of doors. He was seldom known to speak of those early years even to his best friends, but when someone asked him later in his life if he remembered anything about the War of 1812, he told the following story. I had been fishing one day and caught a little fish, which I was taking home. I met a soldier in the road, and having always been told at home that we must be good to the soldiers, I gave him my fish. This shows us that as a child he was generous, and that he had been taught to be patriotic. Another of his memories was of his mother taking himself and Sarah to say goodbye to the grave of his little sister before going far away to their new home in Indiana. Thomas Lincoln sold his claim to the farm in Kentucky for $20 and 400 gallons of whiskey. Whiskey to us seems a strange kind of currency, but it was far less bulky than the corn from which it was made, and as trading was mostly by barter or exchange, it often passed from one owner to another in the process of buying and selling. With the proceeds of his sale and his kit of tools, he boarded a rude raft of his own making and drifted down the creek to the Ohio River, landing some miles below on the farther shore. Here he made acquaintance with a settler by the name of Posey, and leaving his whiskey and kit of tools with him, pushed inland through the dense forest in search of a suitable spot for his new home. On the first day he selected a place near Little Pigeon Creek, 18 miles north of the river, and 1.5 miles from Gentryville. Then he walked back to Knob Creek for his family. Again, the simple preparations to move were made, and the life in Kentucky came to an end. 2 borrowed horses carried their household goods, which consisted of a little bedding and clothing, and also a few cooking utensils. The children were tied to the load upon the horses' backs, the father carrying his rifle to protect the family and provide necessary food. He carried his axe also, that constant companion of the pioneer, not only in the woods for chopping a way through, but at the journey's end for making the home and its rude furniture. On reaching the Ohio River, the horses were set free and headed homeward. A boat carried the Lincolns across the river, and on the other side a wagon was hired from Posey. Then Thomas Lincoln and his family started on their journey northward. As he had to cut a road through the forest, they were 3 days on the way. The four were entirely alone. They had not even a domestic animal, a cat or a dog, with them. The journey must have been a dreary one, for it was the last of November, and the weather was more or less wintry. They had no shelter at night except the leafless trees, nor any protection from the cold except the clothing they wore and the brush fires around which they slept under the open sky. Yet the two children probably had much pleasure out of the changing experience. Having arrived safely at the end of their journey, all set to work with a will to provide a shelter against the winter. Young Abe, though only 7, was healthy, rugged, and active, and all day long he worked with his axe, clearing away the bushes and thick underbrush, while his father cut down saplings and made poles for their camp. This camp, in which they must live until they could build a good cabin, was a mere shed, 14 feet square, with one side open. The poles were laid one upon the other and were topped by a thatched roof of boughs and leaves. As there was no chimney, there could be no fire inside, and it was necessary to keep one burning all the time just in front of the camp. During this first winter in the wild woods of Indiana, the little boy must have lived a very busy life. Beside the building of the cabin, which was to take the place of the camp, a clearing had to be made for the corn planting of the coming spring. A whole year passed before the Lincoln family moved into the newly built log cabin, giving up the camp to some friends, Mr. and Mrs. Sparrow, who had followed them from Kentucky. With the Sparrows lived Dennis Hanks, a young cousin of Mrs. Lincoln. The new cabin had no windows and no floor except the bare earth. There was an opening on one side which was used as a doorway, but there was no door, nor was there so much as a deerskin to keep out the rain or the snow, or to give protection from the cold wind. In this rough abode the furniture was scanty and of the rudest sort. The chairs were only three-legged stools, made by smoothing the flat side of a split log and putting sticks into holes bored underneath. The table was of the same simple kind, with four legs instead of three. The rude bedsteads in the corners of the cabin were made by sticking two poles into the logs at right angles to the walls, the outside corner, where the poles met, being supported by a crotched stick driven into the ground. Then boards were placed across the poles, making a framework upon which shucks and leaves were heaped, and over all were laid the skins of wild animals. Abe's bed was a pile of dried leaves in a corner of the loft, and he reached it by climbing on pegs driven into the wall. In winter, the cold winds whistled about his head. The snow sifted in through cracks, and even the drip of rain fell on his face. The food was simple, but there was usually plenty of it. The Lincolns raised enough corn to supply the household, the meal being made into corn dodgers roasted in the ashes, which was their everyday bread. Wheat was so hard to raise and so scarce that flour bread was reserved for Sunday mornings. The principal vegetable was the common white potato, and sometimes that was all the Lincolns had to eat. We get a flash of Abraham's humor and learn something of his father's religious habits from Abraham's remark to his father, who had just asked a blessing on a dish of roasted potatoes, that they were mighty poor blessings. But as a rule, there was an abundance of game, such as deer, bears, wild turkeys, ducks, and pheasants, many kinds of fish from the streams close by, and in summer, wild fruits from the woods. These were so plentiful that they were dried for winter use. It was easy to get game, for not far from the Lincoln cabin was a glade in which there were deer licks. Waiting 1 or 2 hours usually resulted in getting a shot at a deer, which would furnish food for a week, and also material for moccasins or shoes and breeches. But the cooking was rudely done, because there were few groceries and few cooking utensils. A simple but most useful article in every pioneer household was the gritter. It was a piece of flattened tin punched full of holes and nailed to a board. Many articles of food could be grated on it, and at times the housewife secured by this slow method enough cornmeal for bread. When washing day came, the clothes were taken down either to the flowing stream or to the watering trough, which at that time was the closest approach to our modern set tubs. Indeed, the backwoodsmen had to devise many contrivances to supply their lack of manufactured things. Thorns, for instance, were used for pins, bits of stone for buttons, while for a looking-glass a woman would scour a tin pan. As there was almost no money in circulation, people exchanged or bartered for things they wished, one man paying maple sugar for a marriage license, and another giving wolf scalps. Candles were a luxury much of the time, and Abe, as we shall find later, spent many long winter evenings reading by the light of blazing logs in the rude fireplace. These were busy days for Abraham. As a small boy, he did the numberless chores which came around with surprising frequency to the boy who lives on a farm. He also cut brush, chopped firewood, picked berries, and helped plow and plant. Although in his brief biography, written in the third person, he said that he did little hunting, he told the following story about his shooting a wild turkey. A few days before the completion of his 8th year, in the absence of his father, a flock of wild turkeys approached the new log cabin, and Abraham, with his rifle gun, standing inside, shot through a crack and killed one of them. He has never since pulled the trigger on any larger game. While the boy kept busy with tasks about the farm and helping his father in the carpenter shop, the simple, active life was making his body strong and wiry and his muscles firm and hard. As he grew, he became a tall, slim, awkward boy with very long legs and arms. His dress, like that of all pioneers, was picturesque and somewhat peculiar. He wore trousers and moccasins made of deerskin, and a shirt which was often of homespun linsey woolsey, but sometimes of deerskin. In winter, his cap was of coonskin, while in summer he wore a rough, unshaped straw hat without a band. Probably this costume was very comfortable and well suited to the pioneer's life, but we are told that Abe's deerskin trousers, after getting wet, shrank until they became several inches too short for his long, lean legs. Then his jesting companions called him Longshanks. But the privations of these pinching times, as Lincoln later called them, were as nothing compared to the grievous loss of his mother. The rough life of the forest and the exposure of the open cabin had weakened her naturally frail constitution. Besides, there was much malaria, and in 1818, a frightful pestilence called milk sickness swept away a large part of the people in the little community near Pigeon Creek. Among those who died were Mr. and Mrs. Sparrow, who had occupied the camp, and Abraham's mother. She was the 9-year-old lad's dearest friend. They were knit together by common traits that held them in closest sympathy and understanding. They had the same alertness of mind, the same sensitive feeling, and the same strain of sadness tinging their natures. Before her death, in her final parting, she said to the boy sobbing at her bedside in his first great grief, "Abraham, I am going away from you, and you will never see me again. I know that you will always be good and kind to your sister and father. Try to live as I have taught you, and to love your heavenly Father." There was a long interval after her death and burial before a preacher came near enough this remote settlement for a funeral service to be held. But before a year had passed, it is said, the young boy sent a message to a Baptist preacher who had more than once been a guest of the Lincolns in their Kentucky home and persuaded that good man to come more than 100 miles to hold a service at his mother's grave. The oft-quoted remark, "All that I am or ever hope to be, I owe to my angel mother," reveals the abiding love in which he held her memory. For a year, the family was desolate. Then Thomas Lincoln went to Kentucky to seek another wife and mother for the bereaved home. There he married for his second wife, a widow, Sarah Bush Johnston, whom the family had known before leaving Kentucky, and who became a devoted friend to the motherless boy. When Thomas Lincoln and his new bride came back to the Indiana home, they brought a wagon loaded with furniture, for Mrs. Lincoln was well-to-do. There was a fine bureau, a clothes press, and bedding and cooking utensils such as Abraham and his sister Sarah had never seen. Mrs. Lincoln brought with her 3 children of her own, 2 girls and a boy. There were also now in the household, with the Lincolns, Dennis Hanks, who had come to live with them after the Sparrows died, and a cousin from Kentucky, John Hanks. This made in all a family of 9 in the little cabin, a lively household indeed for the new mother. Sarah Bush Lincoln was energetic, thrifty, gentle, and intelligent. She had been accustomed to better things than she found in her new home, and she insisted that the log cabin should be supplied with a door, floor, and window. She also began to make the Lincoln children look a little more human. In fact, she was a model stepmother. It was fortunate for Abraham that she was bent upon having the children go to school. He was now 10 years old, and he could not write. Although he had gone to school for a short time to two different teachers before leaving Kentucky, he knew little more than the letters of the alphabet. There were no schoolhouses in southern Indiana in those days. Such buildings as they had were rough log cabins, which had been used for homes with earth floors and greased paper for windows. Desks were unknown. Little benches made of split logs after the manner of the stools and tables in the Lincoln home being used instead. The teachers were men of limited education who could teach only a little spelling, reading, writing, and ciphering. During his last school days, Abraham Lincoln had to walk daily a distance of 4.5 miles each way from his home, following no doubt at times the deer path through the forest. His midday lunch was a corn dodger, which he carried in his pocket. He went to school to 3 different teachers in Indiana, but his schooling, all told, lasted less than a year. In spite of his meager opportunities, however, the boy, by his self-reliance, strong purpose, and good reading habits, was acquiring the best sort of training for his future life. At his home, there were no books except the Bible. And of course there were few to be had in that wild country from other homes. But whenever he heard of a book anywhere, far or near, he would go on foot to borrow it. Then he would pore over its contents until he had made everything between its covers a part of himself. To a friend he once said, "I have read all the books I have ever heard of in the country for a circuit of 50 miles. In this way he came to know thoroughly Aesop's fables, Robinson Crusoe, Pilgrim's Progress, the History of the United States, and Weems' Life of Washington, and these were all books of the right kind." His stepmother said of him, "He read everything he could lay his hands on, and when he came across a passage that struck him, he would write it down on boards, if he had no paper, and keep it before him until he could get paper. Then he would copy it, look at it, commit it to memory, and repeat it." Dennis Hanks said, "When Abe and I returned to the house from work, he would go to the cupboard, snatch a piece of cornbread, take down a book, cock his legs up as high as his head, and read. When night came, he would find a seat in the corner by the fireside, or stretch out at length on the floor and write or work out sums in arithmetic on a wooden shovel, using a charred stick for a pencil. When he had covered the shovel, he would shave off the surface and begin over again. He liked to read or study while lying down, and this habit clung to him throughout his life. It was his habit also to copy, either in his copybook or in a notebook which he kept for the purpose, the selections he liked. He used a turkey buzzard's quill for a pen, and the juice of a briar root for a writing fluid. The books that he specially liked he read over and over again, until he knew them almost by heart. One that he had borrowed was Weems' Life of Washington. The first night he had it, he took it to bed with him in the loft, reading until his candle gave out. Before going to sleep, he tucked the book in a crevice between the logs until daylight should come, and he should go on with his reading. Poor Abraham! During the night a hard rain beat in upon the book, soaking it through. With heavy heart he took it back to its owner, who required him to work 3 days to pay for it. Although Lincoln paid the price, he resented the injustice, and later took his satisfaction by writing doggerel verse in which he ridiculed the farmer. Yet the book was worth to him all it cost, for it had a marked influence over his future. Abraham Lincoln's hunger for books led him to devour anything that was printed, even the dictionary, which he read page by page. With absorbing interest, he studied it, evening after evening, until the twilight made it impossible for him to see. He never seemed to get enough. Even the statutes of Indiana were grist for his mill, as the homely old saying has it. The book containing these also had the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution of the United States, and the Ordinance of 1787. Here was the beginning of his study of law, which was an important stepping stone in his career. Such a boy did not need to go to school, for having learned to read and to think about what he read, he was his own best teacher. He learned by reading how other men had won success in life's struggle, and by copying the things he wished to remember, he made them his own. While there was not much need for arithmetic in the backwoods, he knew that in the larger world outside it was useful. In a word, he soon came to realize that the man who knows has a great advantage over the man who does not know, and being ambitious, he strove to give himself the power of knowledge, that knowledge which helps a man make his way in the world. As we have noted, his stepmother was very desirous that he should go to school and also have an opportunity to read books. His father, on the other hand, having never been to school himself, thought that for a boy like Abraham, schooling was a waste of time and that books were useless. To him, it was more important that Abe should be earning money to help the family live. It was for this reason that Abraham was allowed to go to school, but very few weeks at a time, and that at 17, he was taken out of school altogether. In fact, before he was 17, his father had begun to hire him out to the neighbors to do farm work, or whatever the neighbor wished to have him do. For this, the father received 25 cents a day. At times, Abraham and Sarah were both hired out to the more thrifty farmers in the community, Abraham as a field hand and Sarah as an inside helper. While so employed, Abraham, when in the house, was always ready to lend a helping hand to the busy housewife by making the fire, carrying water, or even tending the baby. It was by such simple and homely services that he won friends wherever he was and was always in demand. He was a good worker, but he could not always put his heart into his work. His interest was in other things. A neighbor said of him, "He worked for me, but he was always reading and thinking. He said to me one day that his father taught him to work, but he didn't teach him to love it." In fact, his thoughts were centered in other things than his daily labor. When his employer's day ended, Abraham's day began, because it was then that he took up his books. He read and wrote and ciphered all the time he had for himself. As a worker, however, he gave satisfaction because he was so strong and so intelligent, and he was a good comrade because he had so much good humor and told so many funny stories. Besides being a good storyteller, he liked to make speeches, and by his efforts in this direction, often amused and entertained his friends. When the time for a resting spell from work came, Lincoln would stand upon a stump or climb a fence and make a speech, sometimes repeating in part, with some variations, a sermon he had heard from the lips of a traveling preacher. Sometimes he would use his powers of speech-making in the midst of working hours, and whenever he spoke, he never failed to create a lively interest in his hearers, who would drop scythe or axe or gather around the young orator with genuine admiration. By delaying the work in this way, Abraham often caused his employers to think that his oratory was robbing them of their dues. But he was so good-natured about it all, and so popular among his fellow workers that no farmer could easily complain. Although there was much hard work in those days, we must not think of his early life as altogether one of drudgery and loneliness, for even in the backwoods there were many simple good times to enjoy. In his own home, we may be sure there was much fun and frolic. Thomas Lincoln himself, as we have said, was a good storyteller, and so was Dennis Hanks. There must have been some cheery talk, therefore, around the fireside. Abraham also went fishing with the boys in the creek in the evening. He enjoyed swimming, and during the rests at noon, he and the other boys wrestled and jumped and ran races. After new families had come to the region, there were many social gatherings in that backwoods community, and Abraham Lincoln liked to attend them all. They included horse racing, fox hunting, husking bees, house raisings, log rollings, spelling bees, and political gatherings. where there were speech makings. Of all these occasions, Lincoln was a favorite because of his wit and humor, his rare gift of telling stories, and his practical jokes. He was such a good speller that in course of time, he could spell down anybody at the spelling bees. In fact, it is said that after a while, it was decided not to let him spell at all, for there was nobody that could match him. In his own home, he seemed to be the leader, largely because of his cleverness and kindness. But perhaps one of the strongest reasons why he won and kept an undisputed leadership over his friends and associates was his giant stature and strength. For in a community like that, physical prowess was in itself leadership. He had attained his full growth in height when he was 17 years of age, being at that time 6'4" tall. Then, too, people were proud to be his companions because of his superior knowledge and power as a public speaker. Besides, he was so just that he could be depended upon to settle fairly disagreements among his friends. We must not think of him as a perfect boy. Of course, like all of us, he had his faults. He sometimes disagreed with his comrades, and sometimes the dispute was settled in a rough and tumble way that resulted usually in favor of Abraham, for he was a strong wrestler. After he had grown up, he rarely met anyone in those backwoods days that he could not easily overmatch. It was said that he once lifted and carried a chicken house, weighing 600 pounds, and also that he could lift a barrel of whiskey and drink out of the bunghole, although the narrator declared that Lincoln would not swallow the whiskey. Even though these stories may be exaggerated, they at least show the reputation he had for strength. Gentryville, the village near which Abraham lived, stood apart from the great world of thought and action. No lecturer ever made this little place a visit, and not even a circus came within reach of its inhabitants. It lived its own life, and the center of that life was the grocery store. Here the idlers loitered during the day, and the busy men joined them at night. Could you have entered Jones' grocery store in the evening, you would have seen men reclining on the counter or sitting on kegs and barrels, listening perhaps to a funny story or perhaps to a speaker, at times Abraham Lincoln, who was taking part in the debate. With as much enthusiasm as if the fate of a nation depended upon the outcome, they discussed such questions as whether the Indian or the Negro had received the worst treatment, whether fire or water is the more useful, whether the merits of the bee or of the ant are greater. We may smile at the simplicity of it all, but we must remember that it was at the grocery store in those primitive days in the backwoods that ideas were gained and public opinion formed. The people were superstitious. They believed in dreams, signs, and omens. They would not begin a journey on Friday. If a dog crossed a hunter's path when he started out in the morning, the hunter would have an unsuccessful day unless he at once hooked together his two little fingers and pulled until the dog was out of sight. If a bird alighted in a window or a dog was heard baying at certain hours of the day, it was regarded as a sure sign that death or some other form of calamity would visit the household. Potatoes and other vegetables yielding their fruit underground must be planted in the period when the moon was not full, but those bearing their fruit above ground must be planted in the full of the moon. As there were no churches in those early days, there was little public worship. From time to time, but at long intervals, a traveling preacher would pass through a region. Then nearly all the people would go in large groups to the nearest meeting which he held. If a pioneer had a wagon, his whole family were carried in it, and this was thought of as real luxury. But when families had no wagons, the mothers rode on horseback, carrying the little children in their arms. The men walked, taking along their muskets to be ready to shoot any game they might be able to start up on the way. On arriving at the place of meeting, they all put into a common store the provisions they had brought, and in cheerful companionship ate together in true picnic fashion. If the weather was fair and warm, the meeting was held in the shade of the trees. But if it was rainy or snowy, the people sought the shelter of some vacant cabin. When all was ready for the worship to begin, The preacher took off his coat as a suitable preparation for the energetic speaking which, according to the practice of those backwoods days, was fitting on such an occasion. In all this primitive life of the home and of the community, Abraham Lincoln took a faithful part, but his ideals were higher than those of the people with whom his lot was cast, and he longed to get out of that backwoods country into the great world beyond. The highway to it led through the Ohio and Mississippi rivers down to New Orleans, but this highway was as yet closed to him. It opened up ever so little when, at 17, he found employment with James Taylor, a man living at the mouth of Anderson Creek, where it joins the Ohio River. Abraham's principal business was the management of Mr. Taylor's ferry boat, which plied across the creek and the Ohio River, and his wages were $6 a month and board. It was the custom of farmers living in Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois to collect the produce of their communities on flatboats and float it down the river to New Orleans. Abraham's experience on the river, where such boats were continually passing, made him wish to try a venture of his own. An opportunity came when he was 19 years old, while he was working for Mr. Gentry, a leading man of that vicinity. A trading expedition was planned by his employer to go with a load of produce to New Orleans. Lincoln was to go along with Mr. Gentry's son and aid him in handling the boat and selling the cargo, and for his service he was to receive $8 a month and board. They were gone 3 months on this trip and did not return until sometime in June, 1828. During these months on the river, Abraham must have learned much of the ways of the world and have come more closely in touch with its life. The pioneers with their produce-laden rafts, the houseboats with mothers rocking and children playing on deck, perhaps the family washing, flapping in the wind, the steamers with their city-bred passengers and the ferrymen plying back and forth. All these, to say nothing of the restless life of the brilliant city of New Orleans, were stirring scenes which must have quickened the thought and pulse of the ambitious young backwoodsman. But after this glimpse of the world, Lincoln was again shut in, and once more he took up the petty makeshifts of life in the backwoods.